Okay, it's your turn now. We're going to take your phone calls with our guest, Jonathan Zapp, author, of course, of the book, Crossing the Event Horizon. We shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Jonathan Zapp with us. We'll take your calls. Jonathan, 2012, it came, it went, nothing really happened. What do you think? Why?
Okay, and you probably know one of my close friends, John Major Jenkins.
I sure do. Love the guy. Great guy.
Yeah, and I mean, he's been saying since the 80s, don't expect anything to happen on that date. And I wrote a piece two or three years before 2012 called Carnival 2012, where I was looking at the whole psychological phenomenon of why people were projecting end-of-the-world scenarios onto that date. And it has to do with the dark side of the singularity archetype and apocalypticism, which has been a habit in the human mind that was old already by the time of Zoroastrianism. It may even go back to the Paleolithic, this idea that the world is about to end. You know, we find people saying that on Assyrian clay tablets from 3700 BC. And so what happened is the Mayan calendar, an unsuspecting artifact of another culture, was taken and turned into this projection screen for apocalypticism, the dark side of the singularity archetype. And because, first of all, the calendar did not end in 2012. Like all calendars, it's perpetual. A big cycle ended, but then the next one begins, and it's supposed to be a more favorable one, according to like the Popol View, which is a Mayan document that kind of gives us their basic ideas about cycle changes, which are not apocalyptic, but about shifting into states of renewal. And also, there was no Mayan prophecy that's ever been discovered, not even a single sentence. We have a couple of obscure references to it. It was understood to be an important date, but they made no prophecy about anything that was going to happen, and they would never predict something to happen just on one day. It would be understood that a cycle change is a matter more of decades than of a particular date. So basically, 2012, and John saw this coming a long time before, and so did I, became a focus of psychopathology, of people who were possessed by the dark side of the singularity archetype and wanted to project apocalyptic things onto it. And so this is one of the great habits of the human mind, is to look for an end date, and the end dates that people like always have to be within their expected lifespan. Because then that's what makes a date a kind of sexy date. Because what people really want to do is take their own personal fear of death and project it out toward a collective event. And so this is what's really going on. There's a confusion inside human personalities between inner and outer. So that inner fear of death gets projected out to an outer date, and now that relieves the personal anxiety of having to face it alone. And so that's why we've been through, there's no human enterprise that has failed 100% of the time like end date prophecies have. There have been so many of them. And so here's something that paralleled the whole 2012 phenomenon. A lot of people don't remember. It happened in this country in 1968. There was a woman who was like the second most famous psychic in the country right after Jean Dixon. Her name was Elizabeth Steen. And she started to predict, and this is even written up in the New York Times, ran articles on it because it was such a big thing at the time. She started predicting that on, I think it was August 14th of 1969, there was going to be this unbelievable earthquake that would destroy like the West Coast and so forth. And then other psychics started copycat fashion picking this up. It was a huge media event. And but Elizabeth Steen herself was not there to see it disconfirmed, and that absolutely no earthquake happened on that date, because the day before, she died of a rare form of lupus that's not usually fatal. And so the event horizon came for her, but it wasn't the outer one that she was expecting, and she was quite sincere. She moved her family from the Bay Area at great expense to Spokane, Washington, but there was that confusion of inner and outer, and that personal event horizon of death is constantly projected out by people toward some end date. So 2012 was a nice, convenient one, and people could say anything about the Maya they wanted to, because it's not as familiar as the Bible, so people just made up a whole bunch of nonsense. And I'll make a prophecy for you right now, George.
Okay.
That's going to happen. If your show's still going in 2050, here's what's going to...
2050?
2050. You know,
that'll make me 100 years old. I'll be
okay.
Impressive.
Well, that's possible. That's possible. You know, we've got some life extension going on. So, 2050. What you're going to see for 10 years is all kinds of talk about Isaac Newton's prediction of an end date in 2060. And there'll be movies coming out called stuff like The Newton Code, and everybody will be talking up 2060 because Sir Isaac Newton spent decades of his life studying the Bible and looking for that end date, and he came up with 2060. Well, why doesn't anybody talk about it now? It's not a sexy date because it's too far away. We don't want to have to wait that long for it because some of us won't be alive for it. So it doesn't work for us as an end date because it's too far out there. But when we start getting closer to it, that's going to be they're going to be all people jumping on that and saying that the world will end in 2060 and how can we doubt Sir Isaac Newton and all kinds of stuff like that. So this is just a very familiar habit of the human mind. And 2012 was fascinating to me as somebody who studies the singularity archetype because the things that people projected on it were aspects of the singularity archetype. Jose Aguirre said that he thought we would experience a global telepathic network in 2012. He's wrong about the date, but he's actually capturing one of the aspects of the singularity archetype. So that's why 2012 came and went, but you know, it may be accurate in a way. The Mayans may have been onto something because it certainly looks like we're in a big cycle shift. It's just that cycle shifts don't happen on a particular date. And the more you focus on a future date, the less you are alive right now. And you become more bound in linear time. And the singularity archetype is about transcending linear time. So counting down to the date.
Let me stop you for a second, John. Okay. Do you have like a fan on or something in the background?
Oh, yeah. Let me get that.
Shut that thing off, would you?
Okay. Sorry about that.
Sounds like you're in a wind tunnel or something. There you go.
Okay.
Much better. Much better. Go ahead. Finish up.
So, yeah. I mean, the end dates. Anytime you hear somebody talking about the next one, the next Harold Camping comes along, just ignore them or study it psychologically. But they're almost certain to be wrong. Eventually, we will have an event horizon, but it's probably going to come like a thief in the night, and we may not be able to predict when it's going to happen, and it's not what we need to focus on because every one of us is guaranteed the event horizon because we're all coming up to it through personal death, so we don't have to... We don't have to wait for it to happen for the whole species.
All right, let's take some calls here for you as they line up. We go to Rochester, New York. Keith is with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Keith, go ahead.
Mr. Zapp, at 3:15 Eastern Time, Mr. Norrie asked the question, the way the world is going, where do you see the end result? And even with psychopaths, how would they factor into that? And I'm going to answer that question. There's an old maxim that says you can't con a con man. The flip side to that is it takes a psychopath to fight a psychopath. Mr. Norrie's previous guest was talking about the true story of the Bilderberg group, a bunch of selfish sociopaths and psychopaths. But what about a kind of a French Foreign Legion grouping of guys like me who really would do what the rest of you can't do insofar as retaking the world and getting it back in shape? If the rest of you could look at someone like me, tap me, fully harness me, and there are many more of you, as you were saying, only 1% maybe guys like me, the rest of you would keep me in check. Guys like me would retrieve the world for you, all the rest of you, and you would always have me under your control insofar as not letting someone like me, Keith, get out of line. What would be your answer to that?
Well, I like that idea because I had a very parallel idea that I concluded my piece on psychopathy called Foxes and Reptiles, Psychopathy and the Financial Meltdown. People can find it on my website. They can also, by the way, find an article about the singularity archetype on Reality Sandwich called Avatar and the Singularity Archetype if they can't afford the book. But at the end of that piece on psychopathy, what I suggest is that instead of having people in the SEC that are the MBAs that weren't as good as the psychopathic ones that run Wall Street, that we should recruit the most brilliant psychopaths that we can find, or maybe ones that we have caught, very much like a frequent Coast guest, Kevin Mitnick, who was a computer hacker. And then once he got caught, then the government hired him to catch other hackers and to increase computer security. So I would like to see the SEC have a team of the smartest, most brilliant, ruthless psychopaths who are given huge bonuses when they catch the next Bernie Madoff and when they catch things going on and even give them celebrity status when they do it. So instead of trying to fight a subspecies that's going to be with us for the foreseeable future, I think we should harness their skills to get them to keep after other psychopaths. So it's sort of very much like what the caller is talking about. You know, use everything we've got and don't discount even what the psychopaths can do for us.
And again, let's go back, and I want you to really create this distinction between the sociopath and the psychopath. Which of the two is more harmful to an individual? I would guess the psychopath, right?
And a lot of people complain about these terms, but sociopath is more behavioral. So in other words, a sociopath is somebody who's actually acting out in antisocial ways. So in other words, a lot of sociopaths would be psychopaths, but not all of them. And there are some psychopaths who are not sociopathic, who may be like the brilliant surgeon or the race car driver, who are doing something else that's not destroying society. So from that perspective, the sociopaths are more harmful because the definition of sociopath implies that they are doing harm to society. I prefer a term I created, situational psychopaths, a situational psychopathy, because a lot of people will enter a kind of psychopathic culture like Wall Street, and they will start to act in psychopathic ways. They will become sociopaths because of that culture. And that's what we see play out in the movie Wall Street, for example, the first one.
Michael Douglas, Gordon Gekko, right?
Exactly. So Gordon Gekko, and he's named after a reptile, which is really interesting. It's just one character says, it's like he had an ethical bypass at birth. Well, that's like the perfect one-sentence definition of a psychopath. And he uses this bloody language. He says, we're in the kill zone, lock and load. Or he'll say, like, I want every orifice of his body flowing red. He uses this, like, bloodthirsty language. He has no conscience. He's a classic full-blown psychopath. But then Bud Fox, played by Charlie Sheen, and named after a mammal, but a mammal predator, falls under his spell, starts acting like a sociopath too. He becomes a situational psychopath, as I'm using the term, and he goes with him. But then after a certain point, his conscience kicks back in because he was brought up right and he's not a psychopath, and then he takes down the psychopath. So that's how somebody can stop being a sociopath, but a psychopath can't really stop being a psychopath, though they might become a psychopath who's no longer sociopathic. They can mellow out when they get older, or they can find ways to do their thing without destroying society.
Okay, let's go to Jeff in Culver City, California. Hey, Jeffrey, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
How you doing, George and Mr. Jonathan Zapp? Yes, earlier in the show you mentioned psychopaths are the subspecies. I once read a book by the founders of Clone Aid and the Raelian movement, Mr. Claude Raelian, Vorhelian, and Bridget Bosselier, about genetically engineered cloning techniques. They claim to have created a human clone, you know, human being through cloning. My question is this, Mr. Zapp. Do you believe that they're actually genetically manipulated clones, i.e. subspecies, wandering around and masquerading as human beings, interacting with those of us who are truly human now? And I'll take your answer off there.
Okay. Well, it's funny you bring that up, because in my fantasy work, Parallel Journeys, which I'm writing the second book, looking for a publisher right now, that there's a genetically engineered psychopath who's one of the key characters and represents a key stream of evolution. Whether we actually have clones walking around right now, I don't know. No one's read me into that program. I suppose it's theoretically possible. And it wouldn't surprise me. It would probably wouldn't surprise any of us that that might eventually happen. However, one way to see it happening right now is to see that the psychopaths are more different than us than we realize. They might as well be genetically engineered clones, because people call them the perfect chameleons. And they can be very charming, and they seem so much like us, but they could actually in some ways be more unlike us than, say, a dog or a cat. Because when we relate to a dog, for example, we see a lot of the familiar warm and fuzzy emotions that human beings are capable of, and it's very hard for us to wrap our minds around the fact that this charming, smiling person that we're talking to could actually be missing fundamental emotions that we associate with being human, and could just as soon watch us die as watch, the sunset. And there's no difference for them between seeing somebody tortured and seeing money coming out of an ATM machine. And that even shows up under functional MRI scans. The emotional part of the brain, the limbic part of the brain, won't even light up when they're shown a gruesome sight that the rest of us will respond to emotionally. So really, we don't know if there are secret clones walking around, but we should definitely keep our eyes out for those psychopaths who may be fundamentally different than us, even though they seem just like the guy next door.
Is it safe to assume that most successful people are psychopaths? I don't think that's fair, but what do you think?
No, I mean, obviously there are people who succeed, thank God, in fields, all kinds of fields who are not psychopaths, but we know professions where there is a higher percentage. Like, there's a lower percentage among teachers, but there's a higher percentage amongst religious clergy, believe it or not, is an example of a group that has a higher percentage, because once it's a perfect place to hide. You can be the wolf in sheep's clothing. When you have religious authority, now people trust you, and you learn to talk the rap and so forth. We've already mentioned that it's been shown that there's a very high percentage on Wall Street, and CEOs test out very high in it, and politicians. And, the human resources person interviewing people for corporate jobs, it said that psychopaths are like the perfect job candidates. Because they're decisive, they're charismatic, they don't hesitate, they don't get emotionally entangled. So some people have even suggested that companies might use Robert Hare's psychopathy checklist, considered the state-of-the-art diagnostic tool for recognizing psychopaths, and might actually choose to hire psychopaths for certain jobs, like selling commercial real estate or something, where being charismatic and all confident and so forth would be a great advantage.
Well, that could be. Would you give out your website again, Jonathan?
Thank you. My website is zaporacle.com, and there's a special there on the book for Coast listeners, and it's called Zap Oracle, not because I'm an oracle, but because it has a free online oracle with 664 cards. Anybody can interact with it for free. A free membership saves your readings indefinitely. And thanks to webmaster extraordinaire Tanner Derry for pulling it all together. So that's a place where people can go and read thousands of pages of writings for free, plus hundreds of hours of audio. And thanks for giving me an opportunity to plug that.
Sure thing. We're going to come back and take some final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Karen Dahlman is going to try to talk me into doing a Ouija board experiment. I don't think it'll happen. And then later on, our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, joins us with stories of high strangeness. And if you're out and about and you think you're going to miss the show, well, if you just download the free iHeartRadio app, you'll be ready to go. The iHeartRadio app, so you can stay connected to Coast AM. Welcome back, Jonathan Zapp. We're going to take your calls. Jonathan, tell us a little bit about Reality Sandwich. You're still doing some work for them?
Yeah, absolutely. Reality Sandwich is an online magazine that covers a lot of the themes that Coast to Coast covers. All kinds of interesting stuff going on there. Lots of people writing for them. A lot of coast guests like Rupert Sheldrake and Graham Hancock have written articles for them. And so it's just, you know, it's not competing. It's not a radio show, but it's a place where a lot of this information shows up, and it's been great fun to write for them.
It's a little like the difference between, like you said, our show and Fate Magazine, stuff like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I sort of think about it as a kind of a countercultural version of the Huffington Post. It's just sort of a news place, but for all those stories that get left out of the conventional mainstream news. And up there right now, I've got an article called Avatar and the Singularity Archetype. If you can't afford the book, it'll give you a miniature version and relate it to the movie Avatar, which even has a connection to the psychopathy theme.
Okay. So let's wrap things up by going to final calls. Ron is truck driving in Arizona. Ron, you're up.
Hello, George. Greetings from Arizona here.
Thank you, Ronnie.
Jonathan, great guest, great show tonight. You know, I've been listening to the coast since the early 90s, and one of the things that I really love about it is what you guys were just talking about, is how, you know, so many different guests come from different angles, but it seems like the truth kind of merges in the middle. As an aside to that, I just had a guest in my home recently that I know that your people are talking to about getting on the show, Nathan Crane, that would be a great guest in these kinds of subjects as well. But going back to the caller from New York, I kind of was thinking about something similar to that. You know, asking Jonathan here whether these changes, you know, on the event horizon are something that might come gradual or if they'll be sudden. And, you know, if somebody were to maybe drop a bomb, not saying that I would like this to happen, but if somebody were to drop a bomb on that Marriott there where the Bilderbergs are meeting, would that change the course of events much? And what's happening in the world today, if, you know, maybe a group of SF guys would kind of get control and get rid of some of this cabal, do you think it would change things much in the way things will go in the near future?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is probably not, if it was done in that way. I mean, which would just create an explosion of you know, new security measures because of what would be basically a terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. And so basically there'd be plenty of other psychopathic elites to take the place of any that were brought down in that way. So it's sort of like, here's the new boss, same as the old boss. But you actually do see things like exactly what you're describing play out on the dark side of the singularity archetype in a movie and a novel called The Medusa Touch. It actually had Richard Burton as a star, a major one of the major British actors. He plays a man who is he's kind of psychopathic in that he has a total dislike of other people. He's a real misanthrope, and he also has a power to make things happen, like plane crashes. And something almost like a Bilderberg group is going to happen because all of these world leaders are going to be meeting in a certain cathedral in London, and he decides he's going to bring it down. But again, that's sort of the action of a psychopathic mutant who's going to do things destructively and probably only make the problem worse. Like there's a line in the I Ching about sometimes you can only sharpen the fangs of evil by fighting it. So I think the people that are really going to make the difference are the people who are going to bring about positive things like new technologies and other things that enhance human consciousness. I don't think it's going to be the people who are doing violent things that are really going to trigger the metamorphosis, though I don't rule out anything because sometimes a powerful shock can totally stir things up. But it's definitely not the way I would go.
No, I think that would backfire. I mean, violence against violence just doesn't work.
Yeah, we've been trying that experiment for 6,000 years, and I haven't seen it work that well.
All right, back to more calls. We go to Michael in New York. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hello.
East of the Rockies. Hi,
George.
Michael. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Zapp.
Hey.
George, just a comment on that Ouija board thing. A number of times that I've had people that had problems with it was because there's a demon in behind there that's named George, by the way.
And oh, thanks.
It's a good thing, you know. Mr. Zapp,
mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people, Mr. Zapp, Jonathan Zapp, I think you mentioned Dr. Michael Gross earlier in this show.
Dr. Grosso, yes.
Yeah, he's my teacher. He's tested me a number of times. I could sit here with a cell phone that's not connected and hear his classes, every word and everyone in that class, and describe what he's learning and things like that. I also had spherical experiences and command of the elements like the wind and storms and such. But the most important thing is that I work with love. And I got a letter from Jesus on Easter. I feel like an apostle because of that. Yes, he said, underneath the layer of our reality of the ego, you find that the only thing that there is just pure love. Without what we're experiencing, we would not know who we are or what we're about or anything of that nature. Which reminds me of the story of the littlest angel who wasn't happy because he didn't know what his was besides the heaven of the heart, you know.
All right, and Michael, you said you got a letter from Jesus?
Yes, it's on my blog.
Where was it?
It was actually a young Jewish lady named...
Where are you? Oh, he's gone. Poof,
well,
another one.
I think I agree with the last thing he was saying, that once we break open the ego, then we have a greater sense of love. However, unlike many people, I don't interpret the ego as a bad thing that was a mistake that it ever happened, because as much as when the ego gets too strong, it can take people away from the unity consciousness of love, it served a valuable evolutionary purpose, because I think a kind of group telepathy and unity consciousness is more the norm in nature, like a school of fish or a flock of birds. But when we were able to sort of encapsulate the psyche with the ego and kind of create a firewall between people, it allowed individuality to be created. And individuality is a great engine of novelty, and we are the most highly individualized of all known species. And so the ego served a great purpose for a very long time. But now we have reached a point where egocentric consciousness threatens the species with extinction. And so now we need to break that open and return to a unity consciousness, but one that still preserves individuality. And that exact transformation happens in a lot of the visions of the singularity archetype and the actualizations. Like those who've read the Dune books know that there's a sisterhood called the Bene Gesserit, and they take a life-threatening substance called the Water of Life, which many don't survive. If they do survive, then they have a homo gestalt consciousness. They are aware of all the memories and personalities of all the other reverend mothers who have also survived that rite. So they become transformed into this group consciousness, but yet they still retain their individuality. So I think we need to break open the ego into love, but without losing individuality.
Let's go to Adam in Oklahoma City. Hey, Adam, thank you for holding. Go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Good.
All right, now, Mr. Zapp, I'm sitting here looking at your website as we speak. My wife called me a psychopath 7 years ago. I got to looking into it, and I guess she's right. I've been a police officer, and I brought a couple of people to God. You know, as you were talking earlier about being Christians or men of faith, or people of faith, I believe you're absolutely right about that. I have a great career. I have some things about me that I don't understand. It don't bother me if people die. I know when I should have emotion, but I don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure that
makes him a psychopath, is it?
Actually, he could be. But he could be a good example of how psychopaths, especially who understand themselves and have been brought up in good families, sometimes can have very useful careers. And there's a book called The Psychopath Within. The author's name is Fallon. I can't remember his first name, but he's a neuroscientist. And he was studying brain scans of psychopathic murderers and seeing all these things that they had in common. And then he also, to create like a counterexample, decided to have his own family scan so he could look at some scans that were not of psychopaths. And one of his aides brought those in, and he's just like, oh, looks like you got one mixed in from the psychopath pile, because one of them was like a classic psychopathic, you know, brain scan. Well, it turned out that was his brain scan. And when he started looking into it, he began to realize that he always was a psychopath, and that even his therapist had said that, but he thought he was joking. He was a psychopath who didn't do bad things, but like the caller, didn't have that emotional reaction when people died and that kind of thing. But I think the caller told us something quite beautiful, which is that even the psychopath can learn to do things for society. They can understand themselves and learn to take on jobs that might be risky or upsetting to other people. There is a higher percentage in law enforcement, and they don't have to be the kind of policemen who brutalize people, because some of those guys could definitely be psychopaths. They could be ones that are cool under pressure, but stick to the social code. So if there's a strong enough social code that the psychopath adheres to, and this is why we see less full-blown psychopaths in Asian cultures, where individual going off and being an individual rogue is not supported by the society, the social code is strong enough that it seems to kind of hold them into socially useful places. So it was very encouraging to hear that the caller was able to find that path.
Are all psychopaths evil, or are all evil people psychopaths?
Definitely no to both. So as I just mentioned, there are psychopaths. And first of all, you really can't blame them for being psychopaths. It's largely genetic. It's wired into them. And some of them do find socially useful things to do. And then there's all kinds of really bad people who are not psychopaths. So sometimes people kind of take this psychopath thing and be like, oh, well, I'm one of the good guys. I'm one of the non-psychopaths. Mm-hmm. But actually, there are all kinds of bad people who are not psychopaths, who maybe have narcissistic personality disorder, for example, or just be people that aren't so easy to categorize with any of these labels, which are really, as my writing mentor at NYU, E.L. Doctorow, once called these psychiatric labels the industrialized form of storytelling. We don't want to get so attached to these labels that we think that that they describe everything in human nature. So in a biography of Hitler, there's a quote from the novelist Graham Greene, where he said that some people who became saints were people who had a way above average capacity for evil, and that many people who became evil were people who only narrowly avoided being saints. So it is even possible to have a psychopathic saint who somehow, even though he doesn't have a natural ability for empathy, learns to take the intensity of the psychopath and turn it into doing good.
Let's take a few more calls. Mike, truck driving in New York. Michael, take it away.
I have a question for your guest there. Could a person be both a psychopath and a sociopath?
Now, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure they can. I think it's one or the other, isn't it?
No, there's a tremendous overlap, because, again, sociopath is generally defined behaviorally. It basically means somebody who acts out in pathological ways in toward society and toward the social matrix. And so, of course, a lot of psychopaths do that, but it's not all sociopaths are psychopaths. They can be other kinds of bad people, and not all psychopaths are sociopaths, because some psychopaths, like the person who called in, could be doing things that are not harmful. And so there's a strong overlap between the two, but it's not 100% on either side.
All right, let's grab Chris in Louisiana. Chris, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Yes, I've just started listening to your show, and I'm actually now probably going to be a long-time listener, and I wanted to appreciate your guest for
thank you so much.
Stopping in. And, one, I wanted to say, would a psychopath having a near-death experience maybe change his whole demeanor and maybe make him a little empathetic, or is it just hardwired into even something like that? It wouldn't be able to. And then I also wanted to switch it up and go back to where the near-death experience and the dreams, what he was talking about before, is like my aunt, she has this like intuition where she has these dreams sometimes, and it's foretold like the future. Like she, a couple of years ago, had a dream that she was going to, and she lives in Florida, but she was going to a city nearby, and she had a dream that a white Tahoe was going to cut her off and she was going to get an accident. And a week later, you know, not thinking anything about it, she had this sudden break of, I guess you say, deja vu. And she started slowing down. And sure enough, a white Tahoe went into the lane and she missed the whole accident.
These intuitive dreams, real quickly, if you can, Jonathan, can a psychopath be changed? Can he be fixed?
Well, fascinating question, because the near-death experience is not the only thing I can think of that could be possible to even entertain that, but I don't think it's ever been studied, but I'd love to know the answer. I'll just say this. I hope so, because it's been shown that the near-death experience is able to make the blind see, people who are blind since birth. This is in Kenneth Ring's book, Mindsight, are able to comprehend vision in a certain way in near-death experiences. So if the blind can see, maybe it's possible, I'm not guaranteeing it, but maybe it's possible that near-death experiencers could suddenly discover empathy in that extraordinary state where they're out of their body, and so therefore maybe they're not ruled by their brain wiring as much. And so I think that's holds open something amazingly hopeful, but I wouldn't count on it.
All right, Jonathan, thank you for being on the program, Crossing the Event Horizon. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.